This episode of A Productive Conversation is sponsored by Uplift Desk. In today's work environment, it's essential to find balance and promote well-being, and Uplift Desk is here to make that a reality. With a focus on ergonomics and innovative design, Uplift Desk offers standing desks that not only encourage healthier work habits, but also enhance your overall productivity. Each desk is built with unmatched stability and quality, ensuring that your workspace is both dynamic and durable. The beauty of Uplift Desk lies in its extensive customization options, allowing you to select from a vast array of desktops and accessories to fit your specific work needs and aesthetic preferences. Additionally, Uplift Desk is committed to customer satisfaction, offering fast shipping, free returns, and a 15-year warranty. Transform your office and your health by visiting UpliftDesk.com/timecrafting for 5% off your order. That's UpliftDesk.com/timecrafting to get 5% off your entire order. With Uplift Desk, you're not just investing in a piece of furniture, you're investing in a healthier, more productive future. Again, go to UpliftDesk.com/timecrafting to get 5% off your order today.
Hi, my name is Alan Henry, and I'm about to have a productive conversation with Mike Vardy.
Welcome to A Productive Conversation with Mike Vardy. I'm Mike Vardy, and I'm joined by Alan Henry today. Now, Alan is a service journalist and editor who writes and commissions stories that help readers make better use of their technology and embrace a healthier relationship with it in their lives. He's currently the senior editor at Wired. He was also the editor-in-chief of the productivity and lifestyle blog Lifehacker. He was also previously the Smarter Living editor at the New York Times. We get into a lot during this conversation. The new work rules for the marginalized, I can't speak to, but he certainly can. So let's get to it. Here's my conversation with Alan Henry, a rather productive one at that. Let's get started. Alan, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks for having me. It's great.
So, Seen, Heard, and Paid, the new work rules for the marginalized. Now, when I introduced it, I'm like, I didn't know what to say. You know what I mean? Because know, here's the thing, is as I went through the book, one of my favorite parts in the book, and it's at the very end, is in your acknowledgments. I got to find it real quick here, is what your agent said to you. It was your literary agent. Here it is. My literary agent, William Leterco, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, that's right.
Who met a very nervous me for lunch and explained over a very heavily dressed Caesar salad that this story could do real good for people who need it, and that I absolutely was the person to tell it. And it's spot on. as I went through the book, I wonder if this is, this is probably intentional, but I'd love to get your take on it. So I went through it. There was a lot of like, oh, moments that came to mind. And again, I'm not marginalized. Like I'm not in that arena. And what's interesting is even though you and I both have, you know, you were the editor in chief of Lifehacker, I was the managing editor of Lifehack, I think at around the same time too.
Similar.
We both spoke to people, and we'll get to this, the idea of people who kind of the productivity porn kind of aspect that you bring up.
Absolutely.
But as I was going through it, I'm like, I didn't have a full grasp of the fact that we can give all these productivity pieces of advice and different ways to work, but there's a nuance there beyond the nuance of the personal productivity aspect that you bring to light in here. So when you wrote an article, I think it was for the Times, right? That kind of led to this. When did you decide that it was time to like make it a much broader, you know, a book? Why did you say, hey, it's time to turn this into a book?
Yeah, I got lucky. When I wrote that article for the New York Times, it was what to do if you feel like you've been discriminated against at work. It was really supposed to be that kind of thesis that like, hey, I realized that all of these productivity tips and tools that I had been writing about for so many years were very successful for some people, but not for me. And it took getting into an environment where that was the case in order for me to decide, you know, hey, maybe I should say this to other people. And part of that was because I had had so much success writing about productivity tips and writing about, you know, these tips and tricks and these apps and downloads and things. And then suddenly I was in a world where none of that was helping me. And I said, well, there's got to be a way around this. There's got to be a way to fix this. When I wrote that article, it was partially because I realized that a lot of the reasons the things didn't work for me, that they worked, that worked for other people, had nothing to do with me.
Right.
And when the really the story that led straight to the book was that the my book editor at Penguin Random House sent me an email and said, hey, would you love to, I love this article. Do you want to expand on this idea? That email went to spam. and never saw it. But what didn't go to spam was William LaTorco's email, where he said, hey, do you want to get lunch and talk about turning this into a book? So we did get lunch and we did talk a bit. And then I dug up that editor's email. And just after a quick back and forth with those guys, they were like, you know, there are a lot of people who could probably see themselves in your shoes,
right? Right?
They want the help. They want the apps. They want the tips. They want the tricks. But for some reason, they just keep banging their head against this career wall and they don't know how to get around it. And that's exactly what you've been through. Not everybody has that same experience. So it was pretty easy to convince me. I was like, oh, okay. Well, if I can help some people with this, then I will.
Well, and I think that you bring this up early on in the book about the idea of, when you were working for Lifehacker, the people that were reading it were the people that needed it the least. It was like, like a you know, it was like a moth to a flame, right? Like they just, I mean, you know, and I find that, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but a lot of productivity type and time management type products are generally directed. And this is going beyond, you know, race and all that stuff, but directed towards people who are wealthy, like the higher level, like C-suite types. And there's the people who don't, I mean, they're and you talk about marginalization, and I want you to get your definition of it too, because I think immediately people are going to say, oh, marginalized, it must mean this. There's a, it's like productivity. There's nuance. So let's dive into that. When you talk about the new work rules for the marginalized, what do you mean by marginalized?
Yeah, this is something that I like to tell everybody. Marginalization is for everybody. And usually, you know, when I, in my personal experience, you know, I'm a Black man working in America, you know, I've been subject of microaggressions and prejudice and all of the things that, you know, you could probably assume. But that is an intersectional thing. And like intersectionality is a big kind of concept in social justice circles, meaning loosely that everyone's injustice is someone else's injustice. It all kind of plays into each other. So, I mean, yeah, these work rules apply to people like me who faced, you know, discrimination or hardship because of their ethnicity, but they also apply to women in majority male workspaces and neurodivergent people in predominantly neurotypical workspaces, disabled people and ableist workspaces. And these things apply to everyone. Whenever you're not the cool kid at the table, you're being marginalized. And you probably had an experience where you're like, you know what? I don't understand why everybody is being mean to me, but they are. And I'm suffering because of it. It's causing my it's a challenge to my mental health. It's a challenge to my career growth, and it has nothing to do with me. So what do I do about it? And that's kind of it. That was the thing for me, was understanding that, you know, yes, this thing is out of your control, but what you can do is work around the thing and work around the people. And that's kind of, I wanted to give people a sense of agency, a sense of power. So they didn't feel like, oh, well, if they're going to hate me for who I am, then that's just how it is. On one level, yeah, you can't, you can't change minds, but you can keep doing your best work. And that was the other thing.
Well, and what's interesting is we hear that advice of like, you can't change anyone else's behavior, but change your own. But those rules are different when you're marginalized, right?
Because
it feels, I would imagine, and again, I can't speak to that. I can only, you know, kind of think about it. I would imagine it just feels insurmountable, because no matter how much you try to work through your own behavior, there's just so many different externalization stuff that's going on that it makes it, you almost kind of throw your hands up and go, well, you know, I guess this is the way it is.
Yeah. And that's the unfortunate part, because it is very difficult to kind of wrap your head around. It's there's almost always a point where you do kind of throw up your hands and say, well, what can I do about this? Mm. And the key there, the thing that I tell people, is to not internalize that feeling of despair, because again, it is not something that you choose, right? No one goes to work wanting other people to dislike them, right? No one goes to work wanting somebody to exclude them from meetings. So don't internalize it. Don't make it about you. Just work around it. And I mean, it may require, and I hate this because it asks people who are marginalized for some reason to take on additional work. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you do have to work around those people. You do have to do a little bit extra to forge those bonds and allyships with people who don't have those problems with you that other people might. And through those relationships, you'll find greater success rather than just throwing up your hands and saying, well, I guess this is just how this industry is, this job is, I'm never going to get ahead, or this is how society is. All of those things may partially, at least, be true, but that doesn't mean that you can't still excel. And that's kind of what I wanted to do in the book, was give people some tools to actually say, okay, this sucks. We all agree it sucks, but you can still do something about it.
And one of the things that I talk about when it comes to productivity is the idea of intention, right? Like intention, yeah, plus attention. There's a point that comes up in the book when you talk about positive stereotypes and positives, yeah, in air quotes. And one of the things that was, and I want you to explain this because, and I know it's out of context a little bit, but you can dive, yeah, in.
This episode of A Productive Conversation is sponsored by Shopify. Dreaming of starting your own business or looking to take your current one to the next level? Shopify is here to make that dream a reality. As the leading e-commerce platform, Shopify empowers you to start, grow, and manage your business with ease. From setting up your online store to scaling globally, Shopify provides all the tools you need to succeed in the marketplace. Customize your storefront, manage your inventory, and connect with your customers all in one place. With direct-to-consumer pricing, same-day shipping, and a global community of entrepreneurs, Shopify supports your journey at every step. Are you ready to transform your business idea into a success story? Visit shopify.com/timecrafting to start your free trial and embark on your entrepreneurial journey with Shopify. That's shopify.com/timecrafting to start your free trial. Do it today. This episode of A Productive Conversation is sponsored by 1Password. Imagine a world where forgetting passwords is no longer a hassle and your digital security is uncompromised. 1Password offers a robust, intuitive solution to manage all your passwords with just one master password, safeguarding your information across every device. This isn't just any password manager. It's a comprehensive security tool that encrypts your data, ensuring only you have access. With 1Password, you can generate strong, unique passwords for each of your accounts, store sensitive information securely, and even share important logins with family or colleagues safely. Recognized by Wirecutter as the top pick for password managers, 1Password is the preferred choice for enhancing your online security without the complexity. Enhance your digital security by visiting 1Password.com. And we have a special offer for listeners of A Productive Conversation. Right now, listeners of A Productive Conversation get a free 2-week trial at 1Password.com/productive convo. That's 2 free weeks at 1Password.com/productive convo. 1Password.com/productive convo. Check out what 1Password can do for you, your business, and even your family today.
This stood out. Separate the intent of action from the impact of the action. Mm-hmm. And do you think that, as you explain it, because I'd love to hear you, the context, but also that I think as I read that, it didn't just apply to the people who were being marginalized, but those who were marginalizing.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And it's funny. There's an activist, radio host, Jay Smooth, great guy. He did a video many, many, many years ago called How to Tell Someone What They Did Was Racist. And I found that particularly instructive because the whole point of his kind of YouTube lesson, it was very short, and was to tell people, when you want to address problematic behavior, address the behavior. and address the behavior's impact, not the intention behind it. So intention matters less than effect when it has to do with the way that two people interact. So I'm not like, if someone says something problematic, you say, hey, what you said was problematic. I'm not saying you're a problematic person. I'm not saying you're a bad person. No one, because no one wants to hear that, obviously. And that's not key to changing people's minds or behavior. If you tell them, hey, what you did was problematic, what you did, regardless of your intention, caused harm, then you don't want to cause harm, right? And most people are more receptive to that than they are to, hey, you're bad, but I'm going to cancel you or something like that.
That's a being thing, not a doing thing, right?
Exactly. Exactly the key. So, no one wants to be like, oh, you're a bad person, right? But the thing that you did may be bad. And if it is, then easy fixes, you don't do it anymore.
We're going to get to rule 8 in a minute. But I want to go to something that resonated with me.
Yeah.
Because I hear this a lot and I hear it from a bunch of people. Again, when you mentioned marginalization and I was going through the book, I'm like, these things are prevalent in, I see it in other areas as well, or I see it in areas that I didn't think marginalization was necessarily having as great an impact as it was. There's a piece where you talk about managers.
Yeah.
And you say, and now if your manager is anything like managers I've had, they'll turn to you and say, everything's a priority or it's all important. Then just walk away.
Mm-hmm.
Not unique.
Not unique.
So what this is in the rule, it says only spend time on work that gets you attention. And when I talk about productivity, I think productivity is, again, it's the active link between intention and attention. Mm-hmm. So when you say only spend time on work that gets you attention, there's got to be some nuance there as well, yeah. I would imagine, right? Because sometimes the attention that you would get would be quantitative, like look how much is, as opposed to qualitative, right? So can we explore that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And earlier in the book, I talk about this concept between office housework versus glamour work, right? And but even the housework can be good work, depending on who it's you're doing it for and how well you are at marketing that work for yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So if it is quantitative work, you're piling up those documents and those reports and things. If you're really good at selling the fact that you're really good at doing that work, then you're going to get rewarded for it, right? So I think that's the key, though, is making sure that the work that you do is not just the best work or the best use of your skills, but it's also the best use of kind of your own marketing ability. And I hate to say that because it sounds a little sleazy, but like it's that way of talking about your work to your manager or their manager or even a potential manager at a different, company or something like that in an interview, where you say, I'm really good at doing these things. I'm really passionate about these things, because I know a lot of people who wind up doing things because they're good at them as opposed to because they like doing them.
Right.
So it's difficult, but it's an important distinction.
And when we get to rule 7, where you talk about being a problem solver or not a problem complainer, brings us to mind a quote that I had from when I worked at Costco. One of the managers used to say, if you're going to come to me with a problem, come to me with a solution to the problem, which is, frankly, some people would say that's a cop out. I don't think it is. I think that was him saying, you know what? I'm empowering you, but it was done in a very subtle way. You talk about, again, there's things in here that I think are really valuable. Like keeping an eye on your boss's changing priorities is one thing, because there's so many times back to that earlier question where everything's a priority. It's all important. Yeah. You mentioned that. And this, again, I think this is true across multiple, kind of areas, is that they're not paying attention to, they're thinking about their work. They're thinking about all the things. They don't want to think about the work they've asked you to do. They've got their own.
Absolutely not.
So you've brought up a few times, like having to make sure that you're keeping your eye on things, but that I think that once you lean into that a bit more, Would you say that does it make it easier or does it just make it better?
It makes it better. It's certainly not easier.
Right.
I will say that. Okay. I mean, that's one of those things where like you have to pay if you, no one likes all hands meetings. No one likes corporate board meetings and things like that. But sometimes it's really important to pay attention in those mm-hmm. because you might see a slide. You might hear a tone of voice in some VP or something that lets you know that this thing is going to be a big priority next year, or this thing is going to come down to your department eventually. And eventually that means it's going to be your problem. I had that CIO long before I started writing, long before I got into journalism. And I asked him, I'm like, hey, you're the CIO. You tell me what I should be working on. You know, tell me what is most important to you. And he turned around to me and he was like, everything's important. Mm-hmm. I got everything needs to get done. And I'm like, that sucks, man. Come on. You can do better than that. But he was also trying to tell me, like, you know, listen to the things that I tell you about. And you will get a feeling for the things that I need you to handle now and the things that I need you to handle later. And it took time for me to kind of develop that intuition. And I don't think it comes naturally. It right. is definitely a thing that you have to practice, or if you have like a mentor or somebody who can kind of help you understand or read between the lines, that helps a lot. But it doesn't make it easier, not because it doesn't take any of the work off your plate, right? No. You still have to do all the work. It just tells you when and how to shuffle things around based on, for example, my CIO's manager, his CFO would come to him and say, hey, what's the status on this thing on Monday morning that I haven't talked to you about in months? Well, the CIO is immediately going to turn to his team and say, hey, what's the status on this thing we last talked about 3 months ago? And now it's everyone's priority. If you can get some intuition into that, then yeah, it'll help.
Do you think that the pace of the world and the go, 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 fast, 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 now has a big role in this.
Yes.
Absolutely. It doesn't give us time to think.
No.
Or pay attention to subtext or anything like mm-hmm. that.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think that the pace of work in general, and especially during and through the pandemic, has removed even the free time that we used to have to explore our own best working methods. There used to be a time, at least for me, where I felt like I had the opportunity to try out different kind of, you know, productivity methods and like different tools, see which works best for me. And now I'm very much in a space where I'm like, I don't really try things just for the sake of trying them anymore. I stick to the thing that works for me until it doesn't work. And then I look for something else. But even in the process of looking for something else, I don't feel like I have a lot of time for that.
Right.
Now, I do think that in general, that's a better way to work rather than, you know, trying lots of things and throwing darts at the wall. But sometimes it's fun to say like, hey, maybe there's a better way to do things. And maybe I'm going to spend some time thinking about it. Who has time to think about it anymore?
Well, and before it was your job.
This episode of A Productive Conversation is sponsored by Prolon. If you've ever considered fasting for its health benefits, but can't face the idea of days without food, Prolon offers a novel solution. It's a nutrition program that simulates the effects of fasting while allowing you to eat. Developed by scientists at the USC Longevity Institute, Prolon supports weight management, enhances physical performance, and bolsters gut health through a meticulously crafted 5-day meal program. This isn't just another diet. It's a lifestyle change backed by Nobel Prize-winning research designed to trigger cellular rejuvenation and promote overall well-being. I can't wait to put it through the paces. The meals, ranging from savory soups to nutritious snacks, are all designed to ensure your body achieves a fasting state with the energy you need to maintain your daily routine. Prolon is convenient, providing everything in a single box delivered to your doorstep. I am anxiously awaiting mine. I encourage you to check out Prolon as well. If you're ready to see how Prolon can change the way you think about fasting and nutrition, then right now, Prolon is offering A Productive Conversation listeners 10% off their 5-day nutrition program. Go to prolonlife.com/timecrafting. That's PRON life.com/timecrafting. for this special offer. Head over to prolonlife.com/timecrafting to get started today.
Like in that's true too. And life hacker was absolutely my job.
Well, and that brings me to like rule 8 seemed like the pivot point in the book. So rules 1 through 7 were like setting the table. Yeah. Rule 8 is like, okay, here's a trap though. So don't fall for this trap.
Yes.
Which I would argue that both of us probably helped set to a degree when we absolutely. Worked.
Without a doubt.
and then the remaining are kind of like the lessons. It's almost like the remaining rules. Would you say they're like a postmortem of,
kind of
that? Right. Yeah. Like you alluded to it. So it's interesting because the term productivity porn, I think I first heard Merlin say it in the book. You, I think it was someone from Microsoft, right?
From Google. Vivek Shah.
Google.
Vivek
Shah. Right.
Yeah. But it's true. Merlin was probably the first person to say it.
Yeah. Merlin said a lot of things for the first time. Inbox Zero, true. For crying out loud. I mean.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. You and I could have a whole conversation. Mo and I from Boomerang had a conversation about that a few weeks ago, and she's involved with email. But, I think, do you think that productivity is either warped or broken in terms of the way it's approached today?
Today, I would argue that it's probably better now than it was.
Pre-pandemic, maybe?
Pre-pandemic, yeah. But it is definitely not ideal. Right. I mean, and like you said, we had those days where those halcyon days where everybody had a new app for us to try and then we'd write about it. And then a bunch of people who just tried the last app would say, oh, wow, a new app for me to try, not realizing that we're actually diminishing their productivity. Yep. But I mean, for one, I enjoyed that time because it seemed like there was just so much creativity in the space. And there's just so much passion around finding better ways to work, but like you said, the pace of life and the pace of business and everything has just changed so much that a lot of that joy in trying to tweak your workload to find ways to get more done in less time so you can do important things or do the things you want to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, that's the thing is I think what happened was there was a tipping point where life hackery went from like, let's speed up the things we should speed up so we can do these other things to let's just speed up everything.
Let's speed up everything. Absolutely. And I mean, honestly, I think that was kind of the actual slope, right? Mm-hmm. That was the slide right down, into kind of where we are now, where it's like everything's faster, everything, do everything, do more, do it faster, do it better, and go on, as opposed to remembering that the whole point of trying to increase your productivity is you want to get work done so you can go not work or go do something else, go write a book, go build a cabin, go spend time with your family or something like that, right? And instead now it's like, how can I optimize all the things? How do I optimize, my time with my family, which is a terrible idea, but here we are,
Setting boundaries. I want to talk about that because that I think is a challenge everyone faces, but I would imagine that it's more so. And as I went through the book, I was like floored because the boundaries aren't just time related either. Kind of dive into that a bit? Because I think a lot of people, when they think about boundaries, are like, I'm going to say no, or I'm going to block off this time. And right out of the gate, you said, like, no meeting Tuesdays. People looked at me like I had two heads. But if a white guy said it, oh, wow, it's innovative, right? Yeah. Like, it just, and actually, truth be told, I don't think no meeting days are the best idea anymore anyway. Mathematically, it makes more sense to have no meetings in the after, like, no meetings prior to noon because you gain more time back that way. And it doesn't, and the optics look better. But that aside, boundaries seem to be a challenge. Like,
they are.
So let's dive into that.
Sure. I mean, I think the big kicker there is that it's a matter of respect, right? And it's a matter of kind of professional courtesy. And if you are of a group of people who by default have the privilege of that level of professional courtesy, where people look at you and you are the, or rather, I shouldn't say you are, but you can fall into that person's vision of what a CEO looks like, a manager looks like, a good worker looks like, a professional in your field looks like and behaves, right? Because it's not just looks, but it's also behavior and everything. If you fall into those categories, then you're more likely to be respected. You're more likely to block off your calendar for lunch and not have someone book right over you, you know? And if you don't, then you just don't get that respect. You have to then step up and patrol those boundaries and make sure that people don't book over you. And if they do, you have to play the bad guy. You have to find the most convenient, kind of apologetic, most placating way to say, hey, I'm booked then. Can we find another time? You know, without calling into question why they always do it, but just making sure that you push back every time, because the first time you don't is going to open the floodgates to them doing whatever they want to do with your time. And I also, I think it's an issue of kind of a sense of time ownership, mm-hmm. Where managers can get away with this to a certain extent, right? Because, you know, you're their direct report. And so, hey, I need you when I need you. But, you know, peers and other people in other departments or people who you work with loosely. I mean, oftentimes when somebody wants something, they're thinking more about themselves and their own needs than they are thinking about you and your needs or your space and your time. So they'll just book you regardless, or they'll just demand your attention. They'll send you an email at 6 p.m. and that's super urgent.
Or 13 emails throughout the day instead of batching right. it as one.
Instead of batching it as one. Or and I mean, I know no one likes to talk on the phone, but this is something I learned, you know, as a project manager. I was so phone phobic that my director of project management would be like, just call. Just call. I mean, we were all at our desks and everything. I mean, this was a standard office environment. So we were all at our desks. Mm-hmm. Just call, just get up and go walk over and say, hey, do you have a second? I just had a quick question. And I don't know if I like that advice that much anymore, but because, you know, most of us don't like talking on the phone, but like a text doesn't hurt, mm-hmm. or, you know, a Slack doesn't hurt, or a schedule send for their morning doesn't hurt,
right?
As opposed to 13 emails over the course of the day,
right? And there's also, again, there's subtext. There's like, okay, an email to me, and again, this is all about. And you mentioned this right out of the gate. Yeah. You're saying that there's no way that you can expect to change the way the organization works.
Right.
You have to figure out how to work within the confines of the organization, or you leave. And we're going to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think that you can, and again, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Like, yeah. For example, an email to me is, hey, this is important information, but it's not necessarily urgent. A DM is, right? Mm-hmm. Or a text, even more so, because I'm reaching into your personal space. True. Now, again, there's nuance there. Some people don't know boundaries, right?
That's
so,
true.
So when it comes to that kind of stuff, is that something that, number one, you feel in your role? I mean, you've got a level of expertise too, which maybe others don't that are listening right now. I mean, you have a lot of experience in the productivity and time management space that others may not. How should someone dip their toe into that to say, hey, what if we did this? Or what if we, you know, is that, or is it again, more of that maybe suggestion to somebody who may have the ear of someone? Like
it's a power dynamic thing, right? Yeah, you're absolutely right though. If you're reaching up, making suggestions, I would definitely, well, I just said it, right? If you're reaching up, making a suggestion.
Yeah.
But if you're reaching down or you're reaching across, you know, to peers or direct reports or somebody you work with or somebody that you work with, but are also kind of personally close to, then it's okay to kind of say, hey, is it okay if I text you sometimes? Mm-hmm. And I will always, you know, obviously you want to be a good person about it. You want to say, hey, I'm cognizant of your time and your space. I'm not going to text you after hours. I'm never going to text you and not tell you when I need to hear back from you, stuff like that. Like, one of my best friends does not have Slack installed on his phone, but all of his managers have his phone number. And the understanding there is, if it's truly urgent, text me, regardless of the time. But that's my trade-off for not having Slack installed on my phone. It works for him, right? Now, I don't know if that would work for me, but, you know, and I don't think that could also be a privilege thing, but not in this case. But I think that it's important to remember that, like, there is a lot to gain from even having the basic conversation or basic question. It's basically ask somebody, what's the best way to interact with you? Yeah. And what's the best way to interact with you when I need something quickly? Because, like, I agree with you. Email, to me, I look at my emails, I schedule send things for the next day if I need to reply to somebody. If somebody sends me a DM, I'm going to look at that pretty much immediately. And if they send me a text, please don't, you know. Like, I know I just said it, but I'm just...
But that's you, though. And I think... Yeah. So this is my wife. When my wife saw me when I was preparing for this interview, reading your book.
Yeah.
And she's like, what is that? What's the book about? And I gave her a best explanation I could. Yeah. And she actually, we discussed this, and she said, how with the heat so turned up,
yeah,
on, you know, where everyone feels like they might be walking on eggshells, everyone that's conscientious, let's use that. I mean, Casey Neistat put out a great video yesterday as we're recording this. So this is being recorded well in advance, but he talked about the Kanye West situation. Yeah. And he talked about like people who are watching this are not the people that would be necessarily, you know, listening to Kanye in this situation. Right.
Right.
And I feel as I was reading this book, I found myself going, this all makes total sense to me. Like, how is this not? But then there's also this, like, I would imagine, and again, you're in it. That there's some people that are like, okay, well, like, it gets very, you know, like, kid gloves, yeah, kind of. How do we get past that? How do we? Sorry, we only have 3 minutes. So no, I'm just I mean, this is a start. I have to say,
yeah,
you put this, you know, this book really is something that, as I went through it, I'm like, this is not just for people who are marginalized. This is for people who need to understand that there are people who are marginalized, yeah, that you may not necessarily. So maybe this is the start. I don't know. I mean,
yeah, I would hope so. I mean, and this is something that I tell managers when I have the opportunity to talk to them, is to, whenever possible, embrace a more human-centric, empathetic style of management, because we're all tense. We're all, I mean, we've been living through the past 3 years of, like, social trauma. Mm. And, you know, there's so much we can all gain just from saying, hey, I know that there are business demands and economic demands and all of this, but we're all human beings here. We all have lives. You know, if that person is getting up at 5 p.m. every day to leave immediately, that's not a dark mark on their performance or their commitment to the job. Maybe they have a kid that they need to pick up from daycare because parenting, you know, mm-hmm, like, they just try to think and try to remember that we're all human beings and we're all kind of in this together, and try to show a little bit of empathy for each other. And it'll be easier when people do start to enforce their boundaries, when people do start to speak up and say, hey, I feel unfairly excluded from these things or from opportunities, from projects and things like that, you'll be more willing to listen to them. And the flip side to that is that more people will have the psychological safety to speak up and say, hey, I've been worried about this for a while. Let's talk about it, because they'll know that they can trust you to engage in good faith.
The book is called Seen, Heard, and Paid: The New Work Rules for the Marginalized. Alan, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today. Where can people keep up with you and your work and pick up the book?
At alanhenry.net, alan-henry.net. Links to all my socials and obviously links to the book. Books available anywhere books are sold. And I think the Strand still has some signed copies if you want to order one online. So, yeah. Excellent. And they should by the time people hear this.
Thanks so much, Alan. It's been a really great, productive conversation today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Big thanks to Alan for joining me on the program today. Very important conversation to have. I'm glad we had it. It was productive and important, the kind of conversations I strive to have on every episode of this podcast. You can check out all the important links and anything else, including where to pick up Alan's book at productivityist.com/podcast458. Now, there are two ways to support the show. Number one, you can check out the sponsors page, which will feature some of the sponsors that you heard during today's episode. Just go to productivityist.com/podcast sponsors to make that happen. Now, the other thing you can do, and it's really easy to make this happen, is just hit subscribe on the podcast app that you are using right now, that button, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever. That way you subscribe to the podcast. And that way you don't miss a single episode of what's to come, as well as easily search through the archives and check out all the episodes that we've had leading up to this point, all 457 prior to this one. Super easy, super simple, easy way to support the show. As for this episode, we're done. That's it. That's the end. You've heard it. And now it's time to move on with the rest of your day. I'll see you next time. Until then, I'm Mike Vardy, the host of A Productive Conversation, reminding you to stop doing productive and start being productive. See you later.